Letty worked longer hours and showed real compassion for the dying woman. But Fritz and his sister, the only other sibling, began to grow suspicious about their mother's routine financial affairs. Gradually, Letty had taken control of collecting the bills and writing the checks, though it appeared as if Mrs. Pickering always signed them. Letty kept up with the bank statements, insurance forms, bills, and other paperwork. Fritz got an urgent call one day from his sister, who had found an astonishing document. It was a will handwritten by their mother, and in it she left $50,000 in cash to Letty Lang. Fritz took off from work, sped over to Lake Village, met his sister after hours, and took a look at the will. It had been dated 2 months prior and signed by Irene Pickering. There was no doubt about the handwriting, though it was a much feebler version of what they had always known. His sister had found the will in a plain envelope, stuffed in an old family Bible on a shelf with the kitchen cookbooks. They confronted their mother, who claimed to be too weak to discuss the matter. At the time, Mrs. Pickering had $110,000 in a certificate of deposit and $18,000 in a checking account. Letty had access to the monthly statements for these accounts. The following morning, Fritz and his sister confronted Letty when she arrived for work. During a nasty row, they claimed she had convinced or even coerced their mother into making the will. She denied any knowledge of it and seemed genuinely surprised, even hurt. They fired her anyway and made her leave the house immediately. They loaded up their mother and drove her to a lawyer's office in Oxford, where the sister lived. While they waited, the lawyer prepared a 2-page will that made no mention of Letty Lang and left everything to Fritz and his sister in equal shares, just as they had discussed many times with their mother. She signed it on the spot, died a month later, and the probate went off without a hitch. Fritz and his sister sold the house and property and split the assets evenly without a cross word. Before Irene died, they quizzed her several times about the handwritten will, but it always upset her, and she wouldn't discuss it. They quizzed her about Letty Lang, and this made her cry too. Eventually, they stopped these conversations. Truthfully, at the time she signed the will in the lawyer's office, she was not really thinking clearly, and things did not improve before she died. Over coffee, Clapp listened with growing excitement. With Fritz's permission, he was recording the conversation and couldn't wait to play it back for Wade Lanier.
"Did you keep a copy of the handwritten will?"
Fritz shook his head and said,
"I don't recall doing that, and if we did keep it, it's long gone. I sure don't know where it would be."
"Did the lawyer in Oxford keep it?"
"I think so. When we took Mother to see him, we gave him her prior will, one that was prepared by a lawyer in Lake Village, plus the handwritten will. And I'm sure he kept both of them. He said it was important to destroy prior wills because they sometimes show up and cause problems."
"Do you remember the name of the lawyer in Oxford?"
"Hal Freeman, an old guy who's since retired. My sister died 5 years ago, and I was the executor of her estate. Freeman had retired by then, but his son handled the probate."
"Did you and the son ever talk about the handwritten will?"
"I don't think so. I had very little contact with him, really. I try to avoid lawyers, Mr. Clapp. I've had some very unpleasant experiences with them."
Clapp was savvy enough to know he had discovered dynamite, and he was experienced enough to know it was time to back off. Take it slow. Share it all with Wade Lanier and let the lawyer call the shots. Pickering began to inquire into Clapp's reasons for pursuing Letty, but was met with a wall of vagueness. They finished lunch and said goodbye. Wade Lanier listened to the tape with his customary grim face and tight lips. But Lester Chilcott, his associate, could hardly suppress his enthusiasm. After Clapp was excused from Lanier's office, Chilcott rubbed his hands together and said, "This ball game is over." Wade eventually smiled. Step one, no further contact with Pickering. His mother and sister were dead, so he was the only person who could possibly testify about the handwritten will, other than Hal Freeman. Two quick phone calls to Oxford verified that Freeman was retired, still alive, and that his old office was run by his two sons, Todd and Hank. Ignore Pickering for now. No contact between Lanier's office and Pickering, because it would be important, at a later date, for Pickering to testify he had never spoken to the attorneys. Step two, find the handwritten will at all costs. If it exists, find it, get it. But do so without alerting Hal Freeman, if possible. Find it before Jake or somebody else does. Step three, bury this now and save it for later. The most dramatic and effective use of the handwritten will of Irene Pickering would come at trial, with Letty Lang on the witness stand and denying any knowledge of the will. Produce it then. Make her a liar. And prove to the jury that conniving her way into wills handwritten by her old and vulnerable bosses was a devious pattern. Such a strategy was loaded with hazards. The first and most obvious was the basic rules of discovery. Jake had filed interrogatories requiring his adversaries to divulge the identities of all potential witnesses. Lanier and the other lawyers had done the same. It was standard procedure in the new days of wide-open discovery where everything was supposedly transparent. To hide a witness like Fritz Pickering was not only unethical, but also dangerous. Attempting to produce a surprise at trial was often futile. Lanier and Chilcott needed time to plot ways around this rule. There were exceptions, but they were narrow. Just as troublesome was the plan to find Irene's handwritten will. There was a chance it had been destroyed, along with 1,000 other worthless old files in the Freeman archives. But lawyers generally kept their retired files for longer than 10 years, so the odds were decent that the will was still around. Ignoring Fritz was also problematic. What if another lawyer tracked him down and asked the same questions? If the other lawyer happened to be Jake, then the element of surprise would be lost. Jake would have plenty of time to coach Letty into testimony that might appease the jury. He could certainly spin the story. And he would rage at the violated discovery rules. Judge Attlee would not be sympathetic. Lanier and Chilcott debated the idea of contacting Freeman directly. If the will was filed away in gathering dust, Freeman could certainly produce it without someone being forced to steal it. And he would be a respectable witness at trial. But speaking to Freeman would blow their great secret. As a potential witness, his name would be revealed. The element of surprise would be lost. It might become necessary to approach him later, but for now, Wade Lanier and Lester Chilcott were quite content to spin a web of silence and deceit. Cheating was often hard to cover and required meticulous planning, but they were skilled. 2 days later, Randall Clapp entered the Freeman Law Firm and informed the secretary he was there for a 4 o'clock appointment. The two-man shop was in a converted bungalow, one block off the Oxford Town Square, next door to a savings and loan, and just down the street from the federal courthouse. As Clapp waited in the reception area, he flipped through a magazine and took in the surroundings. No video cameras, no security sensors, a deadbolt on the front door, no chains, almost nothing to prevent even a half-witted cat burglar from sneaking in during the night and taking his time. And why would there be? Other than the usual mountain of paperwork, there was nothing of real value in the building. It was a typical small-town law office, just like 100 others Clapp had visited. He had already wandered through the rear alley and scoped out the back door. A deadbolt, but nothing formidable. His man Irby could walk through either the front or the rear door faster than one of the employees using a key. Clapp met with Todd Freeman and discussed some land he wanted to buy west of town, along the main highway. He used his real name, real job, and real business card, but lied when he said he and his brother wanted to put in an all-night truck stop. The legal work would be routine, and Todd seemed sufficiently interested. Clapp asked to use the restroom and was sent down the narrow hall. Retractable staircase, at least two cluttered rooms chock full of files, a small kitchen with a broken window, no lock, no security sensors anywhere. Piece of cake. Irby entered the building just after midnight, while Clapp sat low in his car across the street and watched for trouble. It was January 18th, cold, a Wednesday, and the students were not out on the town. The square was dead, and Clapp's biggest fear was getting noticed by a bored policeman. Once Irby was inside, he checked in by radio. All was quiet and still. Using his trusty jackblade, he had picked the rear door deadbolt in seconds. With an infrared penlight, he eased through the offices. Not a single interior door was locked. The retractable stairs were flimsy and squeaked, but he managed to pull them down with little racket. He stood in the front window, spoke to Clapp by radio, and Clapp could not see his shadow inside. Wearing gloves and disturbing nothing, Irby began in one of the storage rooms. It would take hours, and he was in no hurry. He opened drawers, looked at files, dates, names, and so on, and in doing so, touched documents that had not been touched in weeks, months, maybe years. Clapp moved his car to a lot on the other side of the square and walked through the alleys. At 1 a.m., Irby opened the rear door, and Clapp entered the building. Irby said, "Every room has file cabinets. Looks like the current files are kept in the lawyers' offices, some by the secretaries." "What about these two rooms?" Clapp asked. "The files date back about 5 years. Some are retired, some not. I'm still looking. I haven't finished the second room. There's a large basement filled with old furniture, typewriters, law books, and more files, all retired." They found nothing of interest in the second room. The files were the typical assortment of retired cases one would find in any small-town law office. At 2:30, Irby carefully climbed the steps of the retractable stairs and disappeared into the attic. Clapp closed them behind him and went to the basement. The attic was windowless, pitch black, and lined with neat rows of cardboard storage boxes stacked four deep. With no chance of being seen from the outside, Irby increased the glow of his penlight and scanned the boxes. Each had a code handwritten in black marker. Real estate, 1176-8177. Criminal, 3181-7181, and so on. He was relieved to find files dating back a dozen years, but frustrated at the absence of any related to wills and estates. Those would be in the basement. After rummaging down there for half an hour, Clapp found a stack of the same types of storage boxes marked probate, 1979-1980. He pulled the box out of a stack, opened it carefully, and began leafing through dozens of files. Irene Pickering's was dated August 1980. It was an inch and a half thick, and tracked the legal work from the day Hal Freeman prepared the 2-page will that Irene signed on the spot through the final order dismissing Fritz Pickering as her executor. The first entry was an old will prepared by the lawyer in Lake Village. The second was a handwritten will. Clapp read it aloud and slowly, the scrawl at times difficult to decipher. The fourth paragraph contained a $50,000 bequest to Letty Lang. "Bingo," he mumbled. He placed the file on a table, closed the box, gently put it back in its place, backtracked carefully, and left the basement. With the file in a briefcase, he stepped into the dark alley and after a few minutes called Irby on the radio. Irby eased out of the rear door, stopping only to quickly relock the deadbolt. To their knowledge, they had disturbed nothing and left no marks. The offices needed a good cleaning to begin with, and a bit of dirt off a shoe or some rearranged dust was not going to attract attention. They drove 2.5 hours to Jackson and met Wade Lanier at his office before 6 a.m. Lanier had been a courtroom brawler for 30 years, and he could not remember a more beautiful example of the smoking gun. But the question remained, how best to fire it? Fat Benny's was at the end of the paved section of a county road. Beyond it was all gravel. Portia had been raised in Box Hill, a dark and secluded community hidden by a swamp and a ridge with few whites anywhere near. Box Hill, though, was Times Square compared to the forbidding backwater settlement of Prairie Town on the backside of Noxubee County, less than 10 miles from the Alabama line. If she had been white, she would have never stopped. There were 2 gas pumps in the front and a few dirty cars parked on the gravel. A screen door slammed behind her as she nodded to a teenage boy behind the front counter. There were a few groceries, soft drink and beer coolers, and in the rear, 12 neat tables, all covered with red and white checkerboard tablecloths. The smell of thick grease hung heavy in the air, and hamburger patties sizzled and popped on a grill. A large man with an enormous belly held a spatula like a weapon and talked to 2 men sitting on stools. There was little doubt as to who was Fat Benny. A sign said, "Order here."
"What can I do for you?" the cook said with a friendly smile.
She gave him her best smile and said softly, "I'd like a hot dog, a Coke, and I'm looking for Benny Rhines."
"That's me," he said. "And you are?"
"My name is Portia Lang, from Clanton, but there's a chance I might be a Rhines. I'm not sure, but I'm looking for information." He nodded to a table. 10 minutes later, he placed the hot dog and the Coke in front of her and sat across the table. "I'm working on the family tree," she said, "and I'm finding a lot of bad apples."
Benny laughed and said, "You should have come here and asked me before you started."
Without touching the hot dog, she told him about her mother and her mother's mother. He had never heard of them. His people were from Noxubee and Lauderdale counties, more to the south than the north. He'd never known a Rhines from Ford County, not a single one. As he talked, she ate rapidly, and she finished as soon as she realized it was another dead end. She thanked him and left. Driving home, she stopped at every small town and checked the telephone directories. There were very few Rhineses in this part of the world. 20 or so in Clay County, 12 or so in Oktibbeha County, near the State University. She had spoken by phone to 12 in Lee County, in and around Tupelo. She and Lucian had identified 23 members of the Rhines family who had been living in Ford County in the years leading up to 1930, before they all vanished. Eventually, they would find a descendant, an old relative who knew something and might be willing to talk. Chapter 26. On the last Friday in January, Roxy arrived for work at 8:45, and Jake was waiting by her desk, nonchalantly scanning a document as if all was well. It was not. It was time for a performance review, and it was not going to be pretty. Things began pleasantly enough when she barked, "Jake, I'm sick of this place." "And good morning to you." She was already crying, no makeup, unkempt hair, the frazzled look of a wife, mother, woman out of control.
"I can't take Lucian," she said. "He's here almost every day, and he's the rudest man in the world. He's vulgar, crude, profane, dirty, and he smokes the filthiest cigars ever made. I loathe that man."
"Anything else?"
"It's either him or me. He owns the building. Can't you do something?"
"Like what? Tell Lucian to be a nicer person? To stop smoking, cussing, insulting people, telling dirty jokes, to sober up?"
"In case you haven't noticed, Roxy, no one tells Lucian Wilbanks to do anything."
She grabbed a tissue and wiped her cheeks.
"I can't take it."
This was the perfect opening, and Jake wasn't about to miss an opportunity. "Let's call it resignation," he said with compassion. "I'll be happy to provide a good reference."
"I'm being fired?"
"No, you're resigning, effective immediately. Leave now, and you've got the day off. I'll send your last paycheck." The emotion turned to anger as she looked around her desk. She was gone in 10 minutes, slamming doors behind her. Portia walked in promptly at 9 and said,
"I just passed Roxy on the street, and she wouldn't speak to me."
"She's gone. Here's the offer. On a temporary basis, you can work down here as the secretary and receptionist. You'll be considered a paralegal, not a lowly intern. It's a big promotion all the way around."
She absorbed it coolly, said,
"My typing is not great."
"Then practice."
"What does it pay?"
$1,000 a month for 2 months, a trial run. After 2 months, we'll take a look and reevaluate."
"Hours?"
8:30 to 5, 30 minutes for lunch."
"What about Lucian?" she asked.
"What about him?"
"He's down here. I kind of like it up there on the second floor where it's safe."
"Has he bothered you?"
"Not yet. Look, Jake, I like Lucian, and we work well together. But I sometimes get the feeling he would like to get a little closer. Know what I mean?"
"I think so."
"If he touches me, I'll slap his ass across the room."
Jake laughed at the visual, and there was no doubt whatsoever Portia could take care of herself. He said, "I need to have a chat with Lucian. Let me handle it. I'll warn him." Portia took a deep breath and looked around the office. She nodded, smiled, said,
"But I'm not a secretary, Jake. I'm going to be a lawyer, just like you."
"And I'll help you in every way possible."
"Thank you."
"I want an answer. Now, on the spot."
"But I don't want to miss the trial. If I'm stuck at this desk, I'll miss the trial, right?"
"Let's worry about that later. Right now, I need you down here."
"Okay."
"So we have a deal?"
"No. $1,000 a month is too low for a secretary, receptionist, and paralegal all rolled into one."
Jake threw up his hands and knew he was beaten. "Well, then, what do you have in mind?"
$2,000 is more in line with the market."
"What in hell do you know about the market?"
"Not much, but I know $1,000 a month is too cheap."
"Okay. $1,500 a month for the first 2 months. Then we'll take a look."
She lunged forward, gave him a quick and proper hug, and said,
"Thanks, Jake."
An hour later, Jake dealt with the second office personnel crisis of the morning. Lucian barged in with hardly a knock and fell into a chair.
"Jake's on,"
he began in a tone that meant trouble.
"I've made a decision. For months, even years now, I've been wrestling with the decision about whether to begin the reinstatement process. Sort of start my comeback, you know?"
Jake, who was hard at work drafting a response to a motion filed by Stillman Rush, slowly put down his pen and managed to look thoughtfully at Lucian. The word comeback had not been used until that point. But in the past 3 months, Lucian had managed to drop every other possible hint that he wanted to become a lawyer again. Though he feared it was coming, this news still put Jake on a tightrope. He didn't want Lucian around, especially Lucian as a lawyer, because Lucian, as an untitled and unpaid advisor, had already worn thin. Lucian as a lawyer meant Lucian the boss, and Jake wouldn't last. But Lucian the friend was the man who'd given Jake a job, an office, a career, and was as loyal as anyone. "Why?" Jake asked.
"I miss it, Jake. I'm too young to sit on the porch. Will you support me?"
The only answer was yes. And Jake quickly said,
"Of course.
You know I will. But how?"
"Moral support, Jake. At first, anyway. As you know, before I can be reinstated, I have to pass the bar exam. No small feat for an old fart like me."
"You've done it once before. You can do it again," Jake said with requisite conviction. He seriously doubted if Lucian could, starting from scratch, grind through a 6-month cram session, studying on his own while trying to lay off the sour mash.
"So you're on board?"
"On board how, Lucian? After you're reinstated, what then? You want this office back? You want me around as a flunky? Do we go back to where we were 8, 9 years ago?"
"I don't know. But we'll figure it out, Jake. I'm sure we can."
Jake shrugged and said, "Yes, I'm on board, and I'll help in any way." And for the second time that morning, Jake lent his assistance to a budding lawyer in his office. Who could be next?
"Thanks."
"While you're here, a couple of housekeeping matters. Roxy quit, and Portia is the interim secretary. She's allergic to cigar smoke, so please go outside and keep your hands to yourself. She spent 6 years in the Army, knows hand-to-hand combat plus karate, and she does not fancy the thought of a creepy old white man pawing at her. Touch her, and she'll crack your teeth, then sue me for sexual harassment. Got it?"
"She said this? I swear I've done nothing."
"It's just a warning, Lucian, okay? Don't touch her. Don't tell her dirty jokes or make suggestive comments. Don't even swear in her presence. And don't drink or smoke around her. She thinks she's a lawyer and wants to become one. Treat her like a professional."
"I thought we were getting on just fine."
"Perhaps, but I know you. Keep it straight and clean."
"I'll try."
"Do more than try. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll get back to work." Leaving, Lucian mumbled just loud enough for Jake to hear,
"She does have a nice ass."
"Drop it, Lucian." On a typical Friday afternoon, it was almost impossible to find a judge in the courthouse or a lawyer in his office. The weekend began early as they all sneaked away in various modes. A lot of fish were caught, a lot of beer consumed, a lot of legal business got delayed until Monday. And on dreary Friday afternoons in January, lawyers and non-lawyers alike quietly closed their offices early and left the square. Judge Attlee was on the front porch under a quilt when Jake arrived around 4 o'clock. The wind was still, and a cloud of pipe smoke hung over the front steps. A sign at the mailbox gave the name of the place as Maple Run. It was a stately old semi-mansion with Georgian columns and sagging shutters, another of the many hand-me-downs in Clanton and Ford County. The roof of the Hocut house was visible two blocks over. Reuben Attlee earned $80,000 a year as a judge and spent little of it on his estate. His wife had been dead for years, and from the flower beds and the sagging wicker porch furniture and the torn curtains hanging in the upstairs windows, it was obvious the place was missing the feminine touch it was not getting. He lived alone. His longtime maid was dead, too, and he had not bothered with a replacement. Jake saw him in church every Sunday morning and had noticed a general decline in his appearance as the years went by. His suits were not as clean. His shirts were not as starched. The knots in his neckties were not as crisp. He was often in need of a good haircut. It had become obvious that Judge Attlee left the house each morning without getting properly inspected. He wasn't much of a drinker, but enjoyed a toddy most afternoons, especially Fridays. Without inquiring, he fixed Jake a generous whiskey sour and placed it on the wicker table between them. Doing business with the judge on his porch meant having a toddy. He kicked back in his favorite rocker, took a long, soothing sip, and said,
"Rumor has it, Lucian's hanging around your office these days."
"It's his office," Jake said. They were gazing across the front lawn, brown and dismal in the dead of winter. Both wore their overcoats, and if the whiskey didn't kick in soon, Jake, quiltless, might request a move inside.
"What's he up to?" Judge Attlee asked.
He and Lucian went back many years, with many chapters in their history. "I asked him to do some title work on Seth Hubbard's property and some research. Just basic legal stuff like that." Jake would never reveal what Lucian told him that morning, especially to Reuben Attlee. If word got out that Lucian Wilbanks was plotting a comeback, most judges in the area would resign.
"Keep him close," Judge Attlee said,
once again dispensing advice that had not been sought.
"He's harmless," Jake said. "He's never harmless."
He rattled the ice around, seemed oblivious to the temperature.
"What's the latest on the search for Ansel?"
Jake avoided his ice and tried to suck down some more bourbon. His teeth were starting to chatter. He replied,
"Not much. Our guys found an ex-wife in Galveston who reluctantly admitted she married a man named Ansel Hubbard 35 years ago. They were married for 3 years, had 2 kids, then he skipped town. Owes a fortune in child support and alimony, but she doesn't care.
It looks like he stopped using his real name 15 years ago and went underground. We're still digging."
"And these are the guys from D.C.?
"Yes, sir. It's a firm of ex-FBI types that specializes in finding missing persons. I don't know how good they are, but I do know they're expensive. I have a bill we need to pay."
"Keep pushing. In the court's view, Ansel is not dead until we know he's dead."
"They're combing death records in all 50 states and in a dozen foreign countries. It takes time."
"How is discovery proceeding?"
"Rapidly. It's a strange case, Judge, because every lawyer involved wants a trial as soon as possible. How many times have you seen that?"
"Perhaps never."
"The case is a priority in every office, so there's a lot of cooperation."
"No one's dragging feet?"
"Not a single lawyer. Last week we took 11 depositions in 3 days, all from members of the church who saw Mr. Hubbard the morning before he died. Nothing particularly interesting or unusual. The witnesses are in general agreement that he seemed like himself, nothing bizarre or strange. So far we have deposed 5 people who work in his headquarters and were with him the day before he wrote the will."
"I've read those," Judge Attlee said, sipping.
"Move along."
"Everyone is busy lining up the experts. I found my handwriting guy and..." "A handwriting expert? They will not stipulate that it is Seth Hubbard's handwriting?"
Not yet.
Is there any doubt?
No, not really.
Then bring it on for a hearing before the trial, and I'll take a look. Perhaps we can settle this issue. My goal is to streamline the issues and try the case as smoothly as possible.
Reuben Atlee wrote the book on streamlining a case. He hated wasting time as much as he loathed windy lawyers. Fresh out of law school, Jake had witnessed the mauling of an ill-prepared lawyer who was presenting a lame argument to Judge Atlee. When he repeated himself for the third time, the judge stopped him cold with,
"Do you think I'm stupid or deaf?"
Stunned and wisely avoiding a response, the lawyer could only look up in disbelief. Judge Atlee then said,
"My hearing aids are working just fine, and I'm not stupid. If you repeat yourself again, I'll rule in favor of the other side. Now move along, sir."
"Are you stupid or deaf?" It was a common question in Clanton legal circles. The bourbon was finally warming things up, and Jake told himself to slow down. One drink would be enough. Arriving home buzzed on Friday afternoon would not sit well with Carla. He said, "As expected, there will be a fair amount of medical testimony. Mr. Hubbard was in severe pain and taking a lot of meds. The other side will try to prove this affected his judgment, so..."
"I understand, Jake. How many medical experts will the jury listen to?"
"I'm not sure at this point."
"How much medical testimony can a jury in this town understand? Out of 12, we'll have 2 college graduates at most, a couple of dropouts, and the rest will have high school diplomas."
"Seth Hubbard was a dropout," Jake said.
"True, and I'll bet he was never asked to evaluate conflicting medical testimony. My point is, Jake, we must guard against overwhelming our jury with too much expert opinion."
"I understand. And if I were on the other side, I would call plenty of experts in an effort to plant doubt, confuse the jurors, give them a reason to suspect Seth was not thinking clearly. Wouldn't you, Judge?"
"Let's not discuss trial strategy, Jake. I don't like to be earwigged. It is against the rules, you know."
He said this with a smile, but his point was well made. There was a long, heavy pause in the conversation as they sipped their drinks and savored the quiet. Finally, the judge said,
"You haven't been paid in 6 weeks."
"I brought the paperwork."
"How many hours?"
210.
"So, something north of 30,000.
"Yes, sir."
"Sounds reasonable. I know you're working very hard, Jake, and I'm happy to approve your fees. But I do have a slight concern if you'll allow me to meddle in your business."
At this point, nothing Jake could say would stop the meddling. If the judge liked you, then he felt it necessary to offer unsolicited advice on a wide range of subjects. You were expected to consider yourself lucky to be so favored.
"Go right ahead," Jake said as he braced himself.
A rattle of the ice, another sip, then,
"Now, and in the near future, you will be well paid for your work, and no one will begrudge it. As you've said, this mess was caused by Seth Hubbard, and he knew it was coming. So be it. However, I doubt the wisdom of you giving the impression you're suddenly in the money. Ms. Lang moved her family to town, into the Sappington house, which, as we know, is nothing special, and has gone unsold for a reason. But nonetheless, it's not in Lowtown. It's on our side of the tracks. There's been grumbling about this. It looks bad. A lot of folks think she's already tapped into the money, and there is resentment. Now there's talk that you have your eye on the Hocutt house. Don't ask how I know. It's a small town. Such a move at this time would get a lot of attention, and none of it favorable."
Jake was speechless. As he gazed at the highest gable of the Hocutt house in the distance, he tried in vain to think of who told whom
and how the word leaked. Willie Traynor swore him to secrecy because he, Willie, did not want to be pestered by other buyers. Harry Rex was a confidant of both Jake and Willie, and though he loved to spread gossip maliciously, he would never rat out inside information like this.
"We're only dreaming, Judge," Jake managed to say. "It's out of my range, and I'm still tied up in litigation. But thanks.
Thanks for meddling once again, Judge." Though as Jake breathed deeply and let the anger pass, he admitted to himself that he and Carla had had the same conversation. Such a conspicuous purchase would naturally lead many to suspect Jake was moving up at the expense of a dead man.
"Has the topic of a settlement been broached?" the judge asked.
"Yes, briefly," Jake answered quickly, eager to move away from real estate.
"And?"
"It went nowhere. In his letter to me, Seth Hubbard was explicit in his instructions. I believe his exact words were, 'Fight them, Mr. Brigance, to the bitter end. We must prevail.' That doesn't leave much room for settlement negotiations."
"But Seth Hubbard is dead. This lawsuit he created is not. What will you tell Letty Lang when and if the jury rules against her and she gets nothing?"
"Letty Lang is not my client. The estate is, and it's my job to enforce the terms of the will that created the estate." Judge Attlee nodded, as if he agreed, but he did not say so. Chapter 27 Charlie Pardue's arrival benefited from fortunate timing. Simeon was gone again. Had he been around the house on that late Saturday morning, he and Charlie would have locked horns immediately, and the fight would have been nasty. As it was, though, Charlie knocked on the door of the old Sappington place and found a house full of women and children. The kids were eating cereal out of boxes and watching television, while the women loitered around a dirty kitchen, drinking coffee and talking in bathrobes and pajamas. Phaedra answered the door and managed to get him situated in the living room, then ran to the kitchen and gushed,
"Mama, there's a man here to see you, and he's so fine."
"Who is he?"
"Charlie Pardue, and he says he thinks he's a cousin."
"Never heard of no Charlie Pardue,"
Letty said, suddenly on the defensive.
"Well, he's here, and he's really cute."
"Is he worth talking to?"
"Oh, yes."
The women scrambled upstairs and changed quickly. Phaedra sneaked out the back door and eased around to the front. Yellow Cadillac, late model, spotless, with Illinois plates. Charlie himself was just as presentable. Dark suit, white shirt, silk tie, a diamond tie clasp, and at least two small, tasteful diamonds on his fingers, no wedding band, a gold chain on his right wrist, and a serious watch on his left. He exuded big city slickness, and Phaedra knew he was from Chicago before he got through the front door. She insisted on sitting with her mother when Letty came back down to meet him. Portia and Clarice would join them later. Cypress stayed in the kitchen. Charlie began by dropping a few names, none of which meant much. He said he was from Chicago, where he worked as an entrepreneur, whatever that meant. He had a wide, easy grin, a glib manner, and his eyes twinkled when he laughed. The women warmed up considerably. In the past 4 months, many people had come to see Letty. Many of them, like Charlie, claimed blood kinship. Given the bareness of her family tree, it was easy to be cynical and to dismiss a lot of potential relatives. The truth was that Letty had been unofficially adopted by Clyde and Cypress Tabor, after she had been abandoned more than once. She had no idea who her grandparents were. Portia had spent hours sifting through the sparse history of their ancestry, with little to show for her efforts. Charlie rattled them when he said,
My maternal grandmother was a Rhines, and I think you are too, Letty.
He produced some paperwork, and they moved to a dining room table where they huddled over him. He unfolded a flowchart that, from a distance, more closely resembled a pile of scrub brush than a properly developed tree. Crooked lines ran in all directions, with notes wedged into the margins. Whatever it was, someone had spent hours trying to decipher it.
"My mother helped me with this," Charlie was saying. "Her mother was a Rhines."
"Where did Pardue come from?" Portia asked.
"My dad's side. They're from Kansas City. Settled in Chicago a long time ago. That's where my parents met."
He was pointing at his chart with an ink pen.
"It goes back to a man named Jeremiah Rhines, a slave who was born around 1841 near Holly Springs. He had 5 or 6 kids, one of whom was Solomon Rhines, and Solomon had at least 6 kids, one of whom was Mary Bell Rhines, my grandmother. She gave birth to my mother, Effie Rhines, in 1920, who was born in this county. In 1930, Mary Bell Rhines and her husband and some more Rhines took off for Chicago and never looked back."
Portia said, "That's the same year the property of Sylvester Rhines was transferred to the Hubbard family." The others heard this, but it meant little. Portia was not even sure of the connection. There were too many missing details.
"Don't know about that," Charlie said, "but my mother remembers a cousin who she thinks was the only child of Sylvester Rhines. As best we can tell, this cousin was born around 1925. They lost touch after 1930 when the family scattered. But through the years, there was the usual family gossip. This girl supposedly had a baby when she was real young. The daddy caught a train, and the family never knew what happened to the baby. My mother remembers her cousin's name as Lois."
"I've heard that my mother's name was Lois," Letty said cautiously.
"Well, let's look at your birth certificate," Charlie said,
as if he had finally arrived at a critical moment.
"Never had one,"
Letty said.
"I know I was born in Monroe County in 1941, but there's no official certificate."
"No listing of either parent," Portia added. "We found this recently down in Monroe County. The mother is listed as L. Rhines, age 16. The father is H. Johnson, but that's the only mention of him." Charlie was instantly deflated. He had worked so hard and traveled so far to prove his lineage with his newfound cousin, only to hit a dead end. "How can you be alive with no birth certificate?" Portia continued,
"My mother was sort of adopted by Cypress and her husband, and she was 30 years old before she knew the truth. By then, so many of her relatives were dead and scattered, it really didn't matter anyway."
Letty said,
"I was married with 3 kids when I found out. I couldn't exactly take off and go chase down a bunch of dead kinfolk. Besides, I really didn't care. Still don't. I was a Tabor. Clyde and Cypress were my parents. I had 6 brothers and sisters."
She was sounding a bit defensive, and this irritated her. She owed no explanation to this stranger, cousin or not. Portia said,
"So, under your theory, it looks like my mother might be a Rhines from Ford County, but there's no way to prove it."
"Oh, I think she's definitely a Rhines," Charlie said, hanging on in desperation.
He thumped his paperwork as if it held the unquestioned truth.
"We're probably 7th or 8th cousins."
"Same as every other black person in North Mississippi,"
Letty said, almost under her breath. The women backed away from the table. Shirley, a sister and one of Cypress's daughters, arrived with the coffee pot and topped off their cups. Charlie seemed undaunted and kept up his barrage of chatter as the conversation drifted away from bloodlines and shaky family histories. He was there looking for money, and he had done his homework. His sleuthing had brought Letty as close to her true ancestors as any effort so far, but there was simply not enough hard evidence to tie up the loose ends. There were still too many gaps, too many questions that could never be answered. Portia eased into the background and just listened. She was tiring of his diamonds and slickness, but she was enthralled by his research. She and Lucian, and now Letty too, were laboring under the unfounded theory that Letty was related to the Rhineses who once owned the land the Hubbards took title to in 1930. If proven, this might help explain why Seth did what he did. And it might not. It might also raise 100 other questions, some of which could prove detrimental. Was any of it admissible in court? Probably not, in Lucian's opinion. But it was worth their determined pursuit.
"Where's the best place for lunch?" Charlie asked boldly. "I'm taking you ladies out for lunch. My treat."
Such a Chicago idea. Black folks in Clanton rarely ate out, and to do so on a Saturday for lunch with such a charming young man, and one picking up the tab, was irresistible. They quickly decided on Claude's, the black-owned cafe on the square. Jake ate there every Friday and had even taken Portia. On Saturdays, Claude grilled pork chops and the place was packed. The last time Letty rode in a late-model Cadillac was the morning she drove Seth to his office, the day before he killed himself. He'd made her drive, and she had been a wreck. She remembered it well as she sat up front with Charlie. Her three daughters sank into the lush leather of the rear seat and admired the well-appointed interior as they headed for the square. Charlie talked nonstop, drove slowly so the locals could admire his car, and within minutes brought up the idea of a wildly profitable funeral home he wanted to buy on the south side of Chicago. Portia glanced at Vidra, who glanced at Clarice. Charlie caught them in the rearview mirror, but never stopped talking. According to his mother, who was now 68 and in good health with a fine memory, her branch of the Rhines family lived near the rest of them and at one time made up a sizable community. With time, though, they joined the Great Migration and headed north in search of jobs and a better life. Once they left Mississippi, they had no desire to return. Those in Chicago sent money back to retrieve the ones left behind, and over time, all the Rhineses had either fled or died. The funeral home could be a gold mine. The little restaurant was almost full at noon. In a spotless white apron, Claude worked the front while his sister handled the kitchen. Menus were not needed. Daily specials were sometimes scrawled on a chalkboard, but for the most part, you ate whatever the sister was cooking. Claude served the food, directed the traffic, worked the cash register, created more gossip than he filtered, and in general ran the place with a heavy hand. By the time Charlie and the ladies settled into their seats and ordered iced tea, Claude had heard that they were all related. He rolled his eyes at this. Wasn't everyone related to Letty these days? 15 minutes later, Jake and Lucian ambled in as if they had just been passing by. They were not. Portia had called Lucian 30 minutes earlier with the heads up. There was a decent chance Charlie could be a link to the past, to the mystery of the Rhines family, and she thought Lucian might want to meet him. Introductions were made. Then Claude set the two crackers off to themselves near the kitchen. Over grilled pork chops and mashed potatoes, Charlie continued to tout the dazzling benefits of the mortuary business in a city of 5 million, though the women were losing interest. He had been married but was now divorced, 2 kids living with their mother. He had gone to college. Slowly, the women extracted the details as they thoroughly enjoyed lunch. By the time the coconut cream pie arrived, the women were completely ignoring him and trashing a deacon who'd fled with another man's wife. Late in the afternoon, Portia arrived at Lucian's home for the first time. The weather had abruptly turned raw and windy, and the porch was out of the question. She was intrigued to meet Sally, a woman seldom seen around town, but well known nonetheless. Her living arrangement was a source of endless condemnation on both sides of the tracks, but it didn't seem to bother either Sally or Lucian. As Portia had learned quickly, nothing really bothered Lucian, at least nothing related to the thoughts and opinions of other people. He ranted about injustice or history or the problems of the world, but was happily oblivious to the observations of others. Sally was about 10 years older than Portia. She had not been raised in Clanton, and no one was quite certain where her people were from. Portia found her to be polite, gracious, and seemingly comfortable with another black female in the house. Lucian had a fire going in his study, and Sally served them hot cocoa there. Lucian spiked his with cognac, but Portia declined. The thought of adding alcohol to such a comfort beverage seemed almost bizarre, but then Portia had long since realized that Lucian had never seen a drink that could not be improved with a shot or two of booze. With Sally in the room and commenting occasionally, they spent an hour updating the family tree. Portia had taken notes of things Charlie had said, important things like names and dates and throwaways, like deaths and disappearances of people who were not related to them. There were several strains of Rhines's in the Chicago area, and another bunch in Gary. Charlie had mentioned a distant cousin named Boaz who lived near Birmingham, but he had no contact information. He also had mentioned a cousin who had moved to Texas, and so on. Sitting by the fire in a fine old home, one with a history, and sipping hot cocoa made by someone else, and talking to such a noted rogue as Lucian Wilbanks, Portia at times couldn't believe herself. She was an equal. She had to constantly remind herself of this. But it was true, because Lucian treated her as one. There was an excellent chance they were wasting their time chasing the past, but what a fascinating search. Lucian was obsessed with the puzzle. He was convinced Seth Hubbard did what he did for a reason, and the reason wasn't sex or companionship. Portia had gently confronted her mother and, with all the trust and respect and love she could humanly muster, had asked her the big question. No, Letty had said, never. It was never considered, not on her part anyway. It was never discussed, never a possibility. Never. Randall Clapp slid the envelope into a drop box outside the main post office in downtown Oxford. It was plain, white, legal-sized, no return info, and it was addressed to Fritz Pickering in Shreveport, Louisiana. Inside were 2 sheets of paper, a full copy of the will handwritten by Irene Pickering and signed by her on March 11, 1980. The other copy was locked away in Wade Lanier's law office. The original was in the file stolen from the Freeman Law Firm, 2 blocks down the street. The plan was for Fritz Pickering to receive the anonymous letter, notice it postmarked in Oxford, open it, recognize the old will, and wonder who in the world had sent it to him. He would probably have a hunch, but he would never know for sure. It was late Saturday night. The college bars were rocking, and the police were more concerned with that activity than with the petty break-in of a small law office. With Clapp in the alley watching things, Agent Irby entered the rear door, and within 5 minutes had returned the Pickering file to its proper and long-neglected resting place. Chapter 28. On Monday, February 20th, Judge Attlee assembled the players for a progress report. Since it was not an official hearing of any variety, he locked the courtroom to keep reporters and spectators away. Most of the litigants were present, the Hubbards on one side, Letty and Fidra on the other. Still no sign of Ansel, though Judge Attlee was not quite ready to declare him dead. He assumed the bench in his robe, managed a gruff, "Good morning," and called the roll of lawyers. All present. It was soon obvious the judge was not in a good mood and probably felt bad. In a tired voice he said,
"Gentlemen, this matter is scheduled for a jury trial 6 weeks from today. I am monitoring discovery, and I see no reason why we can't be ready to go on as planned on April 3rd. Am I missing something here? Any reason to delay the trial?"
Serious head shaking followed. "No, sir. No reason at all." As Jake had said, it was indeed a strange case in that every lawyer was eager for a trial. If anyone wanted to stall, it might be Jake. He had every reason to drag things along at $150 an hour, but he had Judge Attlee breathing down his neck, too. The case, officially known as In Re, Estate of Henry Seth Hubbard, was barreling down the docket at record speed. The judge continued,
"Now, Mr. Brigance has copies of the first inventory for your perusal. As I have instructed in writing, this is to be kept as confidential as possible."
Portia began handing over copies to the other side.
"I have sealed this section of the court file because nothing good can come from the dissemination of this sensitive material. You, as the attorneys and your clients, have the right to know what's in the estate. So take a look."
The lawyers snatched the copies of the inventory and flipped through the pages. Some had heard the alleged value, but they still wanted to see it in black and white. $24 million and change. It validated what they were doing, why they were fighting. The courtroom was deathly silent for a few moments as it sank in. More money than any of them could ever hope to earn in a long career. Then there were some whispers and a chuckle over a wisecrack. Judge Attlee said,
"I address the contestants now. In reviewing the discovery, it seems as though you may have plans to challenge the validity of the handwriting. You have listed two experts in this field, and I assume the proponents will need to employ their own. I've looked at the handwriting samples, specifically the will, the burial instructions, the letter Mr. Hubbard left behind on his kitchen table, and the letter he addressed to Mr. Brigance, dated October 1st. I have also seen the other samples of his handwriting that have been filed. Now, Mr. Lanier and Mr. Rush, do you plan to seriously contend that this will was written by someone other than Seth Hubbard?"
His tone left little doubt about how he felt. Rush and Lanier stood slowly, neither eager to respond. Lanier said,
"Your Honor, we're still debating that point." "Well, hurry up," Judge Attlee said rudely. "It's a waste, and you're wasting my time. A blind man can see it's his handwriting. Any expert who saunters into this courtroom and says otherwise will be laughed at by the jury and scorned by the court."
And with that, the handwriting issue was settled. They sat down. Lanier whispered to his sidekick, Lester Chilcott,
"What else has he already decided?"
Judge Attlee looked at Jake and growled,
"Mr. Brigance, any progress in the search for Ansel Hubbard? 5% of this inventory is a lot of money."
"Well, no shit, Judge," Jake wanted to say, as he was jolted out of another thought and stood properly, though rattled. "Not really, Your Honor. The search has turned up very little. It appears as though Ansel began using different names a long time ago. We found no proof that he's dead, and certainly nothing to prove he's alive."
"Very well. Next on my list is a discussion about the jury pool. It's been over 8 years since I presided over a trial involving a jury, and I admit to being a bit rusty. I've spoken to Judge Noose, Judge Handelford, and others, so I'm getting good advice. They seem to think a pool of 100 will be sufficient. Gentlemen, nothing. Good. I'll instruct the clerk to pull that many names at random from the voter registration rolls, and I'll make the list available 2 weeks before trial, the same procedure as in circuit court. There will be the standard precautions and warnings against unauthorized contact with the potential jurors. This is a high-profile case, gentlemen, and at times I'm almost convinced every person in this county already has an opinion. Jake stood and said, "In that case, Your Honor, perhaps we should consider a change of venue. Requesting one is up to you, Mr. Brigance. I've seen nothing in writing." "I haven't done so. I'm just speculating here. If most of our prospective jurors know about the case, then it seems like moving the case might be the proper thing to do." "Mr. Lania," Judge Antley said, looking at the other lawyers, "Mr. Rush, Mr. Zeitler, anybody?" Wade Lanier straightened himself up with great frustration. "There's never been a change of venue in a will contest in Mississippi. Not a single case. We've done the research." Lester Chilcott was suddenly clawing his way through a thick briefcase. "And it seems a bit broad to declare that everyone in this county has formed an opinion before we presented the evidence." Chilcott handed him a thick brief. "Here it is, if the court would like to take a look. Not a single case." Jake was impressed with the research, Judge Atlee less so. He said, "I'll take your word for it, for now. I'll review the research later." Jake wasn't serious about moving the case because he wanted it to stay in his courtroom. But there were advantages to having the trial in another county. These included, 1, the possibility of more black jurors, 2, avoiding the lingering damage caused by Booker Sistrunk, his mouth, his race baiting, and his black Rolls Royce, 3, finding jurors who hadn't gossiped about Letty and her family, their problems, and their new rental home outside Lowtown, and 4, selecting a jury untainted with endless speculation about Letty and Seth Hubbard and what they were really up to. These factors and issues had been debated by Jake, Lucian, and increasingly Portia as the weeks passed. They could debate all they wanted, but it was a waste of time. Judge Atlee was not moving the case, and he had said as much to Jake. So Jake was bluffing and enjoying the sight of his opponent scrambling in opposition. He said, "Judge, if you think every person in Ford County has an opinion, then I'll file a motion to change venue." Judge Atlee said, "I have a better idea, Mr. Brigance. Let's summon our pool and start the selection process. We should know immediately if we're wasting our time here. If it looks as though we can't pick an impartial jury, then we'll just move the trial somewhere else. There are lots of courtrooms in this state, at least one in every county." Jake sat down, as did Lanier and Stillman Rush. Judge Atlee rustled some papers, then launched into a discussion about the remaining depositions. With the lawyers in a remarkably agreeable mood, scheduling posed few problems. A pretrial conference was set for March 20th, 2 weeks before the trial. The meeting was adjourned. The meeting reconvened 15 minutes later in Judge Atlee's office down the hall. Lawyers only. No clients, paralegals, clerks, or anyone else who couldn't be trusted. Just the lawyers and the judge, who had taken off his robe and was puffing away on his pipe. When they were seated, he said, "Gentlemen, for the next few minutes or so, we will at least have a discussion about settling this matter. I have no reservations about going forward with the trial. Indeed, in many ways, I'm looking forward to it. Jury trials are rare for me, and seldom am I dealt facts as intriguing as those presented here. Nonetheless, I would be remiss in my role as the impartial referee not to explore ways to arrive at an outcome that will give all sides something, though less than what they would like. There's a lot of money on the line here, gentlemen. Surely there's a way to slice the pie and make everyone happy. A heavy pause as he sucked hard on the pipe stem. May I make the first proposal? As if he needed approval. All lawyers nodded yes, though cautiously. Very well. Take the two smaller bequests of 5% each. Pay the church in full. Put Ansel's in a trust until we figure what to do at a later date. Take the remaining 90% and split it three ways. One-third to Letty Lang, one-third to Herschel Hubbard, one-third to Ramona Hubbard Defoe. If we assume a tax bite of 50%, then each of the three will walk away with something in the neighborhood of $3.6 million. Far less than what each wants, but far more than each will get if the other side wins. What do you think?
I'm sure the church will take it, Jake said.
It kind of leaves us high and dry, Your Honor,
said Zach Zeitler, the attorney for Herschel's children.
Same here, said Joe Bradley Hunt, the attorney for Ramona's kids.
Of course, Judge Atlee said. But it's safe to assume the children will get no small benefit from such a settlement. Their parents get a windfall. Surely it will trickle down. Perhaps you could stipulate that a portion be held in trust for the kids. Just an idea.
Perhaps, Zeitler said, cutting his eyes around at the other attorneys as if his throat was in danger.
Interesting, Wade Lanier mumbled. I think my folks would consider it.
Same here, said Stillman Rush.
His Honor chewed on his battered pipe stem and looked at Jake, who at the moment was stewing because of the ambush. He had not been forewarned of this impromptu settlement conference, and he certainly had no clue that his old pal was planning to throw some numbers on the table. Judge Atlee said,
Jake?
Jake said, You all have copies of the letter Seth Hubbard wrote to me when he mailed along his last will and testament. His instructions to me are rather explicit. His wishes and desires regarding his two adult children could not be clearer. I suggest you all read the letter again and the will. I represent the estate, and I have my marching orders. My job is to uphold Mr. Hubbard's will and see to it that his children get nothing. I have no choice. I will not be a part of any compromise or settlement.
Should you discuss this with your client? Stillman said.
My client is the estate, which is represented by Mr. Quince Lundy, the administrator.
I'm talking about Letty Lang,
and I don't represent Letty Lang. We have the same interests, the validation of the handwritten will, but I'm not her lawyer. I've made that clear to everyone, especially to her. As an interested party, she has the right to hire a lawyer, which she tried once, but he wound up in jail.
I kind of miss old Booker, Wade Lanier said, and again got a few laughs.
Jake pressed on. My point is that I'm not her lawyer.
Stillman said, Sure, Jake, technically, but right now you have more influence with her than anyone else. Hell, her daughter is your paralegal or secretary or whatever.
I have quite a staff.
Wade Lanier said, You can't tell us, Jake, that if you went to Letty and told her she could walk away with over $3 million in 2 months, hell, 2 weeks, she wouldn't grab the deal and run.
I don't know what she would do. She's a proud woman who feels scorned by the community. She wants her day in court.
$3 million might ease some of the scorn, Lanier said.
Perhaps, but I will not be a part of a compromise. If the court wishes, I will resign as the attorney for the estate, but as long as I'm here, I'm not authorized to settle. Judge Attlee relit his pipe with a match and blew some more smoke. He leaned forward on his elbows and said, "Gentlemen, I think he's right. If this will is proven to be valid, that is, if the jury believes Mr. Hubbard was of sound mind and not unduly influenced, then we have no choice but to follow the terms of the will. It is explicit. The adult children get nothing." "Maybe," Wade Lanier thought to himself, "but you don't know what I know. You haven't seen the Irene Pickering will. You don't know that Ms. Letty Lang has a history of worming her way into the private matters of her employers, and when the jury hears and sees this, the adult children of Seth Hubbard will do quite well." Jake's principled defense of his dead client's last will, as well as his somewhat cocky belief that the trial should be held in Clanton, in his courtroom, was severely shaken by a tragedy that occurred later that night in an ice storm near the town of Lake Village in the southern part of Ford County. Two brothers, Kyle and Beau Roston, were driving home after a high school basketball game. Kyle was Clanton High's senior point guard. Beau was a sophomore substitute. An eyewitness in a car behind them said the driver, Kyle, was proceeding with caution, not in a hurry, and handling the road conditions with skill. Another vehicle topped a hill at a high rate of speed and began sliding. The witness watched in horror as a crash became inevitable. He estimated Kyle was driving about 40 miles per hour. The other vehicle, an old pickup, much faster than that. The head-on collision sent the Rostons' small Toyota flipping through the air and into a ditch. The pickup spun wildly into a field as debris littered the road. The witness was able to stop in time and give assistance. Kyle died at the scene. Beau was extracted by rescue personnel and taken to the hospital in Clanton, where he immediately went into surgery. The trauma to his head was severe, and he was barely alive. The other driver was also hospitalized, but his injuries were not serious. His blood alcohol content was twice the legal limit. A deputy was parked outside his room. The other driver was Simeon Lang.